Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending the hour talking about sexual harassment and the Me Too hashtag that has women speaking out about inappropriate and illegal behavior, sometimes years after the incidents have taken place. But what many women are calling out is more than an isolated incident of inappropriate flirting. It's about it's rapidly becoming a conversation about the culture that we live in, the culture in government, the culture in media, the culture in the arts. We want to hear your thoughts this hour on the topic. Send me a text at 605-956-SDPB or an email in the moment at sdpb.org. So let's start by meeting our panel of experts for the hour. Here with me in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls, we have Tracy Lund. She's a human resources director for Lewis Drug. Tracy, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Just move that a little bit closer to you there, Tracy. Sorry about that. And then Stephanie Pochop.
Thank you. I'm a lawyer from Gregory. I'm in Johnson, Pocup, and Bartling. And
Pocup. Thank you. That's what I was searching for there. I knew I had just gotten your name wrong. I apologize.
I'm married a Bohemian. But the focus of my practice is in employment discrimination, particularly sexual harassment claims.
All right. And in our SDPB studios in Vermilion, we have Dave Lane. He's assistant professor of sociology at USD. Dave, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And in a little while, we're going to be joined also from here on the phone by Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels, because some allegations have been reported in the Argus Leader and other news sources about some women lawmakers and lobbyists who have talked about the Me Too hashtag, used it to identify things that have been happening in Pierre. So let's get started here. First of all, you know, one of the questions that just seems to be coming up again and again as I talk to women and men that I know is, why are we still talking about this? Why is it a hot button issue right now? And I'm wondering, Dave, if maybe you might want to start out with that. What is it that seems to be the groundswell right now?
Well, there are a number of reasons for this, but one of the things that I began to think about when you invited me here was a little bit of analogy to victimization in general. If we think about the traditional ways that people make others aware of something, often it's telling people via face-to-face communication or things being presented in news media. And when I say news media, I mean traditional media such as print sources and various online things that end up getting filtered through editors as well as news producers. But when we think about victimization in general, these people that are victims, we often don't know their stories. They are our neighbors, they are our colleagues, our coworkers, our friends, family members, community members, and we often aren't aware. And here we have this media source to distribute information where people can do so, and all of a sudden they're seeing that all these other people have a similar story to me, or they have something similar that happened to them, like me.
So many people with similar stories. So let's talk about some of the things that you have found interesting about this, Stephanie. Let's start with you. What has been interesting or has caused you to sort of ponder what's going on with this Me Too hashtag and with women's allegations right now?
Well, in a professional sense, I would say that people calling to report what they view as a harassing work environment is a fairly constant thing in South Dakota. I stay pretty busy handling that type of claim. However, the thing that there has been an uptick in it, and I think any time that we shine a light that this is an issue that affects other people, that makes people more willing to come forward. But the thing to me is, like, outside of my law practice, the groups of women and the groups of professionals that I run in it's a thing where when you sit down to have coffee with somebody, this comes up and somebody says, "Huh, I'm a hashtag me too. I myself am a hashtag me too." And I think to myself, well, what did I do about it? You know, when I compare about it, and it does really kind of raise that thing about, okay, I feel some sense of guilt, I feel some sense of shame, and I feel some sense of, a little touch of fury is probably in there, but more than anything, I'm like, what can I do so that this does go away? Why are we still talking about this? Tracy and I were talking before this that if I never got another call about this, it would be one of the happiest days of my professional life.
Right. Tracy, let's ask you, what have you found interesting about the hashtag and the stuff that you've seen on social media?
Well, that's a great question. I think that social media campaign, as tragic and sad as it is very eye-opening. I think about those individuals that do not have the fame, they do not have the celebrity or the financial status to report. So I think about the folks on the other end of the spectrum, those folks that are flipping burgers at pick your fast food restaurant, that are truly paycheck to paycheck, that job, having that consistent paycheck is so very critical. So to me, that is certainly part of the reason why I think there's a reluctance to report, is the concern of retaliation, the concern of the fear of how are others going to treat me at the business, let alone my boss. As soon as I report this, how long is it going to take before my job is terminated? So I think that is part of the concern, and I think this unfortunate movement, as sad as it may be, I appreciate it. Similar to Stephanie, I think there are so many of us, myself included, that have those stories to tell. And sadly, I think getting some traction, it's finally getting it out. It is getting folks to talk about the conversation. We're also getting more men involved in the discussion. And I think that is paramount to hopefully bringing this cycle to an end.
Dave, she said something Stephanie did earlier about, you know, that sense of guilt that women can feel that they didn't say something, or even now there seems to have been, you know, a little bit of pressure to, you know, for women to come out and speak. Can you speak to that at all, this sort of a sense of people feeling a pressure to reveal something that's deeply personal that's happened to them? Is that a new sort of phenomenon here?
There are a couple things at stake here, but I don't want to completely switch topics. A lot of this deals with consciousness raising. People often don't know about their circumstances. And one of the things we have going on here with a movement is simply letting people know that there's an issue they ought to be worried about. There's an issue they ought to be concerned about. There's an issue that they ought to do something about. And again, with something like resources and challenging, say, a fast food organization and somebody who's living paycheck to paycheck, often people aren't aware of the inherent inequities in social systems. And one of the things that's going on with this is people are getting information that they need to participate, that they may have suffered from some circumstances that they shouldn't have. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I'm curious also about what Tracy said, the involvement of men. Then I've talked to many men who are, you know, on board and supportive of the women who are coming forward, and then I've talked to other men who are sort of, you know, hesitant, afraid, confused. What can I say? What can I not say? What do you think the role is of men in this conversation?
This is a very complex question and more than we can answer in this time period.
That's why we invited you, Dave.
As I see it, and this is some of my criminologist side coming out as well, one of the things we know about victimization is the vast majority of it is perpetuated by men. And we're not going to do much about that problem until we start really challenging the ways that we understand masculinity and making it a much more complex and nuanced masculinity, one that isn't solely based on doing it for the guys, which when we think about guys hanging out with guys, they tend to objectify women and they tend to celebrate things like violence and competition with one another. And until we start to challenge those cultural features, we're kind of leaving men out of this, and being that men disproportionately are the ones causing this kind of victimization, we ought to think about that. And I don't want to switch the topic solely to talk about men here either.
No, of course not. Let's talk about what this is and what it isn't. Can we go there? Because the vast majority, I'm sorry, there's such a wide range, is what I mean to say, of different claims that I'm seeing on social media, some which are I would classify as really obnoxiousness, and all the way to, you know, a criminal rape. So when we talk about sexual harassment, and maybe we can narrow it to in the workplace, Tracy, give me an idea of what it is and what it isn't.
You know, there really is no cookie cutter answer. What might be considered egregious as far as harassing behavior to one, maybe tolerable to another. And so it really All is driven based upon that individual, how that behavior, the comments, the gestures, the joking, the touching, whatever the case may be, how that impacts that individual. So when we have claims of these allegations, first and foremost, we must take those seriously in the workplace. So truly, that allegation trumps anything else that might be on the agenda for the day. Requires immediate attention, immediate investigation, immediate reassurance to that complainant or that victim who's coming forward. I always think about how long it's probably taken the victim, if you will, to come forward, knowing again some of the things that Stephanie has shared, the guilt, the humiliation, the what did I do to cause this, feeling alone in this. And that's where, again, glad the social media hashtag is really gaining some traction, that hopefully folks do feel more comfortable reporting it, especially when they see the employers taking those claims seriously, investigating it, following through. And unfortunately, in some cases, folks lose their positions when those investigations do have merit.
Dave, is there a value in just, if something is never reported, you have someone else to talk to? Is there value in that when you talk about raising the consciousness, that's sort of happening on a social playing field? What about this deeply personal thing where all of a sudden, you know, someone might be empowered to just tell their sister for the first time that something happened? What's the value in those sort of, you know, more introverted connections?
Oh, there's certainly a lot of value in sharing stories with people who you're close with, or people who've gone through similar circumstances, because we find groups of we find community or cohesion in those kinds of groups, and that often can be empowering. It can be very difficult and challenging as well, but simply emotionally relating to others, it matters a lot for how, for our own well-being, I should say.
Stephanie, how challenging is this to prove or to have some kind of consequences for, I guess?
You know, I think that does depend, that always depends on the individual facts of the case, on the individual, on the, on how serious an employer is about following what their HR policies are. I know that people often, there's a stereotype that applies that people are fearful to come forward, come forward because they think that they won't be believed. That's probably a number one fear. And I think that's a reason that people hang back. But an important part of the Me Too hashtag, I think it is empowering to know that other people just like you and other people way different than you have had this experience, and they've gotten through it, and they want to do something about it now.
Right.
I think that's the real value of it.
Dave, do you see that, a cry to really do something?
It's a consciousness raising, and not to reiterate what's just been said, but people realize that there's an actual issue going on, and if people aren't communicating about an issue, we're completely unaware of whatever grievance or troubling condition exists out there. And there's something to this sharing on social media, in which we have a different mechanism to diffuse or distribute information about a grievance or longstanding issue.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels is on the phone. He will join the conversation. All our guests will stay here. And again, we are ready to hear from you. If you have some questions about this overall conversation that you'd like to participate in, send me a text, 605-956-SDPB, or email me at inthemoment@sdpb.org. We'll see if we can ask your question to one of our guests. Stay in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending this hour talking about the Me Too hashtag and its impact within the state of South Dakota. We've got a panel of experts with us today In Vermilion, we've got Dave Lane, who is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of South Dakota. Here with me in Sioux Falls, Stephanie Pocop. She's an attorney from Gregory, past president of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association and the State Bar of South Dakota. Also with me here at the University of Sioux Falls SDPB Studios, Tracy Lund. She's a human resources director from Lewis Drug. And now we'd like to bring on the phone from Pierre, Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels, into the conversation. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lori, and thank you for broaching this topic with all your experts. It's an honor.
One of the reasons that I said from the beginning that I wanted Lieutenant Governor Michaels to join us on the show was really twofold. One, obviously, because of your role in Pierre. And second, you and I both have that military background, and in the United States military, sexual harassment is sort of pounded into your head from the first day that you get there. And I'd say the training is... the awareness and the training is top-notch. I'm not saying that they've solved the problem of how to eliminate sexual harassment in the military, but definitely they make a strong effort. So, Lieutenant Governor Michaels, let's start with that a little bit, and then I want to get into some of what's been happening with the Me Too hashtag as it directly relates to Pierre. But what's your specific background with this topic?
Well, first of all, personally, I've found it interesting and heartening that the topic is discussed a lot more in public just generally, and also that these type of efforts, and every time there's media that brings it up, that we can have constructive discussions about it. I would say conversely that social media has certainly modified the way that a number of people deal with this, and if that allows folks to open it up, that's super. I think that the dark side of it also is what I refer to a lot as anti-social media, that is put out there without a whole lot of knowledge or experience or the desire to actually find the facts. With that being said, I personally have been through a number of professions in the healthcare world, both as an EMT and as a nurse. There was never a whole lot of conversation about when you were harassed, and I was. When I was younger, I remember individuals touching me in places that I didn't think was appropriate, and that was in a workplace. And also, as a nurse, there was a preconceived notion about my sexual orientation, and so that was also strange and something that I needed to adjust to, but never was there as much clarity as to purpose and how we could deal with things like that until I actually got in the military, dealt with harassment. The reason I use the word harassment is it can be sexual, it can be an abuse of power, it can be offensive, it can be posters, it can be obviously touching and those things. And it doesn't have to be opposite sex. And I think some of the military experiences I had that were the most, because there weren't as many women in contrast with your experiences, Lori, was the abuse of power by men, even on younger men. And that was some of what I was involved in prosecuting because of senior enlisted harassing younger enlisted. And we started in the 80s, thankfully, with a great push to integrate services with women. And we've just had the USS South Dakota submarine team that was here, and our submarines are fitted out for women. And everybody has the same capabilities. So not only is there training, or what they would say in seminars is sensitivity training, but just as important, and I think when you and I have talked about this, is knowing where to go when you feel uncomfortable. To how do you address that? How do you feel, as they would say, empowered? How can you come forward regardless of what's transpiring to say, hey, I don't like this? And in addition to that, how you can escalate that, including filing complaints, even all the way, I'm sure, as Stephanie has talked about, litigation, if it's being perpetrated in a broad sense, and just like is occurring with a lot of the national media on these issues. But as you well know, it is just general treatment of human beings with respect to the mission in the military anything that causes distrust, fear, concern takes away from the missions of making sure that we take care of people. In South Dakota, I have responsibility for our guard, and we have Army and Air Guard that thankfully has a lot of leaders in of different backgrounds, diversity of not only sex but by creed as well as race. And I'm very, very heartened when we review climate surveys, which are really asking people privately, how are things going? And there is a specific segment in there about feeling oppressed or harassed or sexually harassed. And that is a very big focus, and thankfully is not recognized as a significant issue, but consistently and persistently, as you've said, trained on and recognized with sensitivity.
Let's talk a little bit about recent allegations about the culture in Pierre. There was an article by Dana Ferguson, Megan Raposa at the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. They contacted women lawmakers. Lobbyists came forward and said there was a variety of things that they had complaints for. Governor Dugard made a statement about zero tolerance and encouraging those women to continue to speak out. And I'm wondering what kind of conversations you have had since the Me Too hashtag sort of snowballed across the borders about how this needs to be addressed in Pierre.
Well, thank you for asking that question, because it gives me an opportunity to say that probably the most damaging aspect of media is the possibility or the indirect or direct desire to generalize. There is no culture in Pierre, as might have been intimated, just as there's no culture on a military base or culture in SDPB. Right now, that those generalizations are harmful, hurtful to a lot of individuals. That doesn't diminish the fact that people felt, for whatever reason, that they needed to express their views. To answer your question, we just had a large economic development event we call the Hunt, the Governor's Hunt, where people come together from all over the state, and we encourage people to come and meet them and invest in the state, and it was highly successful. I was approached by a number of legislative leaders who happened to be women, that they were viscerally upset that their interviews were not included, which would demonstrate what they would view as the other side. I don't want to get into that. I think that I've stated my point that we have zero tolerance. If there's something less than that, a lesser threshold, I've dealt with it, and feel free to ask me, with individuals in almost my 16 years in public service, three quarters of it presiding and having responsibility, similar to some extent like Tracy has as human resources, with individuals coming together in the legislature or in the executive branch. And I think that there is a much more complete story here to be told by individuals who are in our legislature. But the governor and I talk a lot about this. Not only do we have zero tolerance, but we've got mechanisms to take action, mechanisms to access any sort of complaints, and it's within our executive branches to explain what was discussed in those media dialogues has to do with the legislature. And the governor and I don't have direct oversight over that, although when we're in session, it is not uncommon for just issues to come up, whether they're health care issues or issues of procedure or issues of people feeling uncomfortable. And as president of the Senate, they'll come to me. And I've experienced this when I was Speaker of the House, which is really the human resources officer and head for the House of Representatives. Pierre is an amazing community of great, great people. And any sort of impression that, again, that there's something in the process of legislating that people have to walk around. I don't think that that is accurate. I know it's not accurate. Walk around on eggshells or have different behavior. And hopefully in the future you would ask other legislators who happen to be women for their view, because obviously I've been a legislator. Obviously I'm lieutenant governor, but I'm not a woman, and so they'll have to speak for themselves.
Tracy Lund, I'm wondering, when we talk about zero tolerance, what does that mean in from a practical standpoint? I get what it sort of means philosophically, but what does it mean practically?
From a practical standpoint, to me it means if you see something, you hear something, you observe something, you have an obligation, whether you are directly involved or not, to say something, to say that behavior, those actions, those words are not acceptable. Not acceptable to me, not acceptable to the company, and you have an obligation to report that, whether it's to your direct supervisor, whether it's to the HR department. But we cannot take action from a leadership standpoint if the allegations are not reported.
And I'm also curious, Lieutenant Governor, about this, what you said about culture, that there isn't a culture. And I think many people are saying, well, there's an atmosphere where something is tolerated. I think that's what they're getting at. Is that how you see culture, or are you seeing that somewhat differently? You're defining it differently.
Well, I do think that that's a slippery slope. I don't believe it exists. That in no way, as Tracy has emphasized, indicates that people are turning a blind eye to it. And the fact that individuals have made those complaints involving a few folks, one is one too many. But to paint a broad brush, they are incredibly respectful people up here. We have a whole bunch of different people around. You throw a few hundred people together and you're going to have that sort of interaction, regardless of where you're at, that is not right and comfortable to folks. What has been done in the legislature process, and what I've experienced, for example, is individuals like Tracy has said to me, and by the way, I will not talk about it. People come to me in confidence, and I'm so privileged that they feel comfortable enough to do that. But I first, you know, they have come to me in confidence. And a couple of years ago, this happened. And the only reason I'm going to bring this up is there was some reference to me in one of the media outlets that an individual had come to me. I can't, you know, identify whether that's accurate or not, because that individual came to me in confidence. What I will say is, like Tracy has said, and Stephanie knows, is that unless, you know, first of all, I always say, and this is true in the legislative protocol, the legislature is responsible for their own individuals. And we're responsible also for state employees collectively. So, for example, Lori Walsh, you encounter a circumstance that you feel is uncomfortable, you look exactly to our policy as a state employee what that process is, and it's on the first page of our human resources policies. And it is to report it to your supervisor, et cetera. And in the circumstance that I'm thinking of, one, just like Tracy pointed out, is there something that you wish to report? Because I'm not going to challenge the validity, the accuracy, which I think is the most dangerous part of these conclusions and some of the media, is people then will start to ascribe motives. I don't. I think it takes an incredible, in fact, I've seen it in my life, how much courage it takes to be able to, by perception or reality, make a complaint against a supervisor or somebody with a position of power based on harassment, and especially those that are sexual. So number one, the complaint individual would come to me, and I would say, what is it that you would like for me to do? And a lot of times it will be suggestion. I'll say, well, here's the policy. Did you address it with the individual? Do you think it's not being handled? And again, it's sort of a dual hat when you've got this a legislative role. And my recommendations are, let's take it to the supervisor. So in the legislature, in what you've seen in the media, that supervisor is the Speaker of the House. And in the Senate, if it occurred in the Senate, it is the President pro tem of the Senate. And if it's within an environment, for example, I've dealt with a few times, we have state employees where somebody who is another state employee said, you know, would you care to go out for a date? And they've come to me and said, this individual's feeling uncomfortable. I can't really get to them. I'll say to say, no, I don't want to go on a date. I'll say they probably aren't fully realizing how they're being and not getting that message. What would you like for me to do? And a few years ago, an individual said, I just really wish that you would, on my behalf, tell him to not ask me out for a date. I did that. The individual didn't understand that it was being perceived that way because the communication wasn't very good, and one individual didn't want to hurt the other person's feelings, and that took care of it. I don't, again, want to minimize it. If there's anyone listening that happens to be a state employee, heck, I don't care if it's an employee, or has a complaint or concern, especially that which, one, makes them uncomfortable, and two, if it's illegal. I prosecuted a lot of child sexual assault, individual assault cases that we are, the governor and I, are zero tolerance, but in your organizations, you should not live under that specter.
Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels, I know you have a busy schedule. We're going to take a break, let you go do what you need to do. I'm going to say thank you to you right now, sir, for taking the time today.
It's my privilege, and thank you to having Dave and Stephanie and Tracy there, too, and I appreciate what they do, too, for us. And take care, and I suppose you saw the USS South Dakota folks. Even though you're a Marine, you're part of the Navy. You know, enjoy that.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to do some more with that submarine in the future there, sir. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thank you.
We'll be back with more on this conversation with Dave, Stephanie, and Tracy in just a minute. Stay in the moment. STPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending the hour talking about sexual harassment and the MeToo hashtag. We've got folks with us. Tracy Lund is a human resources director, is human resources director for Lewis Drug. Stephanie Pocop is an attorney. She's past president of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association and the State Bar of South Dakota. And David Lane is joining us from Vermilion today. He's assistant professor of sociology at the University of South Dakota. We're going to start with Stephanie. Thoughts on what the governor said? We continue that conversation where we left off.
You know, I had two things that I really wanted to say about Lieutenant Governor Michael's comments. First of all, I appreciate very much him sharing that he, too, can sign on to a MeToo hashtag. I think that speaks to the fact that, you know, there are more connections and we often have much more in common with other people than we know. I think it also speaks to an important fact, which is that this is not, men are not the only people who can harass or make other people feel very, very uncomfortable. So I really appreciate him sharing that. And I think that's another thing about why MeToo hashtag really resonates with so many people, because we can kind of publicly acknowledge the Lieutenant Governor and I have something in common, and that we know what that feels like to be horribly uncomfortable and worried about what's going to go on primarily with your career. And that's the real paradox to me, is that, you know, a peer who bothers you at work or chases you around after work can make your workplace uncomfortable and even hostile. But a successful manager or a powerful mentor can be a wrecking ball to your self-esteem and your economic success. And oftentimes, these are the most dangerous people who can trigger a MeToo hashtag are the most successful ones. And it is because they are successful with other people. They are in the group. They're in the group that you want to be in, that you know, that anybody would want to be in. We strive, a lot of us want to curry favor with those people because we see that as the ladder to success. And the higher you up on the ladder, unfortunately, to me, it seems like the more difficult it is to get people to believe you that you would do that. And sometimes when you're in that upper echelon and you just look and see your successful friend and you don't know whether he is using his power for good to truly mentor people or to try to build these unilateral one-sided relationships for his own personal gain, I mean, that I think is the disconnect that we're having about culture. Culture is what other people on the outside of the leadership group feel about it too. And it can be really difficult to see when you're very successful and when you yourself would never treat another person with such disrespect or disregard.
Dave, what are your thoughts on this whole conversation about, you know, how we define culture or how we define an atmosphere or the tone? Somebody sets, we say, you know, in some ways that's not a problem, but when you look at how many women and men have come out and said, me too, clearly we have a problem in America, right?
I would totally agree with that. I mean, when we think of culture, we think of the active practices of a people. And in this case, if a number of people are reporting this, and it is true and it is happening, obviously it's part of our culture. So we can't ignore that that's a reality. We might not like it, but it is part of what we do. Although I did have another comment about the lieutenant governor that struck me as interesting as a social problem scholar, in that he mentioned that all of a sudden, national news media has focused on this. And when we think about social problems, and these are part of our culture, right? Somebody has to make a claim, and every problem is in competition with other problems to get published in national media cycles. And over the last year, we've had a number of high-profile cases of sexual harassment or assault being reported by national media. And I haven't done an analysis of this, but if I go back historically, we've had a lot probably in a short amount of time, so it's on public consciousness as an issue right now.
I remember being in the Marine Corps in, I think it was 88, and it was Paula Coughlin, who was lieutenant in the Navy and was at a conference in the Tailhook Conference, and it made the cover of the Navy Times, where she was forced to run down the gauntlet, and everybody grabbed her, and that was the first time that I had ever heard the word sexual harassment, and all of a sudden it seemed like everybody was trying to define what it even was, but it was one high-profile person, and that goes back to what the governor was saying about courage, or maybe it was someone here who talked about courage. Tracy, do you want to talk about how much courage it takes someone to come forward in their workplace and say, this is a problem?
Oh, I think that is a huge, huge part of the discussion today, is recognizing that that individual has all of these doubts, these questions that we've talked about, feeding off of some of the things that Stephanie shared, whether that person feels ownership. What on earth did I do that I am deserving of this behavior? The emotions, the humiliation, the embarrassment, the question, will anybody believe me if I do have the courage to report it? So when I do have these individuals that do come and report this to me, I try to put myself in their perspective, in their shoes, always coming back with, you know, this is not something they've taken lightly in the decision to report it. So it really emphasizes to me, in the HR chair, the urgency of investigating, of taking this complaint seriously, of keeping things confidential. And truly, this is also on the other side, protecting the person who is being accused. Devastating to, you know, make a decision based on first blush without interviewing the appropriate parties, getting the facts on the table, truly making that independent decision. Like I said earlier, either side of the table, whether the victim or the accused, the decisions that we make in the HR chair and the leadership chair has that potential to be career-ending for an individual. Same token, if for some reason that claim is not found to be valid, making sure we give education back, that we close the loop on the report to both parties is paramount.
Both individuals are at risk of losing a career here, in the sense if you do nothing, as Stephanie was saying. And there have certainly been people who have said, we'll find another job. And women have come back and said, that's not the solution to the problem, is for me to go, you know, leave my career behind and try to find some place where the grass is greener. The solution is to make this stop.
You know, in terms of the courage that it takes to come forward and report. There's another, besides the immediacy of how it feels to risk your job and your economic future, because in my experience, most people are at work because they need their jobs. They're not doing it just for fun. You know, they got a house payment, or they've got, you know, a decision like that can affect your ability to send your kids to private school or your ability to send your kids to summer camp. And there's a tremendous economic pressure on it, but there's a collateral damage aspect to it too, in terms of whether your claim is meritorious or not. And that is, like, reporting puts you in the spotlight of, is she going to be identified as a person who is difficult to work with? I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can be affected. You can, and if you're going to report and that gets out that you are a person that's difficult to work with, dramatic is kind of a, like, almost a code word for somebody who is willing to report when they are faced with something intolerable. I mean, you can see the positive aspects of your job reassigned to somebody else. And so while it isn't overtly punitive, it really is, and it can really have a long-term effect not only on your career success, but just on your self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And then you really wonder, did I just do that to myself? Wouldn't it be better to gut it out? The answer that I think Tracy and Dave and I and the Lieutenant Governor all agree on is no, it's not. Like, nobody can do anything about it if you report.
If you don't report, yeah.
Right. You know, there's kind of a joke among employment law lawyers that there's rarely a zero-tolerance discrimination policy that is applied any more than 50% of the time. But, you know, you've got to trust your HR, and you've got to at least try. Because the Me Too hashtag and the experience that all of us are sitting here talking about today, I think it is going to make a difference in how people really perceive this. I think it's going to make a difference in how HR people approach them. And, you know, if that doesn't work, you can always contact a lawyer. But know your policies and and go and say, this is a zero tolerance policy. Help me. And I think that will help employers a lot.
Dave, I want to I'm looking at your bio, and I see you're the chair of the Social Problems Theory Division of the Society for the Study of Social Problems. Now, we could spend a whole hour just talking about that. But is this a social problem that we can solve, or how should we be thinking about it in order to address it?
Certainly this can be a social problem. The ways that at least the social problems, or I should say the group of scholars I'm involved with approaches social problems, is that there are thousands of things that can potentially become problems out there every day. But somebody first has to make a claim that X is a problem and that we ought to do something about it. Then those claims need to be diffused to a public audience, and we need to then have that public conversation. I think what we have here is a kind of problems claim that's emerged a little bit differently. And when I say differently, classically, these would emerge from news media sources such as newspapers or television news. And when we think about those kinds of sources for news information, a lot of decisions are made that affect the form and content of stories. There's a limited amount of space. There's a limited number of reporters. Sometimes editors make decisions over what's newsworthy and what's not. And with something like Twitter diffusing this, you don't have those same constraints. Now, maybe it's 140 character constraint, but you don't have editors who can say, well, that's not really newsworthy. Or maybe it's not in direct competition with other stories, so this is actually the public conversation. Versus, in the classical sense, wouldn't news media have to distribute something? Then the public would respond to whatever claims of some putative condition are out there. So where I see this going is, and this is sort of the classic social problems process, somebody's made a claim, it's now a discussion in the public, and at some point, activists and experts are going to start standing up and demanding things. And as soon as they start pushing a certain direction, then we tend to see social problems claims then being discussed by officials. And then officials will implement some kind of a plan for action. And then years later, we'll evaluate whether or not that was effective. But that generally is how social problems unfold as a process. I hope that made sense and wasn't too technical.
No, it's fascinating. And my question, of course, is, you know, people are standing up and demanding things, and what we're hearing from the officials are saying, we have a zero tolerance policy. The mechanisms are in place, and yet there's how many women on social media saying, yeah, that didn't work for me. Your mechanisms didn't work. Your zero tolerance wasn't effective. So I think a lot of people would argue those mechanisms are in place, and a lot of other people would argue, yeah, but how come they're not working? How come how come so many women are saying me too? Then if those we've already addressed this problem 150 different times.
Was that a question, or I think it was?
It was a slight rant. It was a perspective and a question, saying that, you know, so what about the people who are saying, you know, what is the action that remains to be taken that hasn't already been taken? The question.
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that, and there's a lot to this, right? Maybe people don't have access to the information, or maybe we're now dealing with a solution to a problem that was once effective, but now it's not as effective. Or maybe the solution needs to be evaluated because what we thought was the solution isn't as effective as we imagined it would be when it was created. Is that clarifying that?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm going to punt that to Tracy. Is there some point where you say, hey, maybe the solutions that we have in place aren't effective as speaking broadly as human resource professionals and as leaders? At some point, do we all sit back and say, maybe this isn't working as well as we thought it was? What else can we do?
That is a great question. To me, the first place we have to start is, again, with zero tolerance, training each and every employee with what is and what is not acceptable behavior, creating, again, that culture that folks do report. They do report on behalf of another male or female that they feel has been victimized. And again, leadership, we have to take these claims, each and every one of them, seriously, demonstrate we are doing everything we can to get to resolution, communicate that resolution. And again, when employers do not take these actions seriously, we're very fortunate that there are great counsels. There are Stephanie Polkups of the world that will, again, advocate on behalf of those who have been victimized.
Stephanie, we're going to give you the last word. We've got about 30 seconds left.
Thanks. I think a really good rule of thumb is to not only yourself, but for those that you mentor or that you can reach, treat everyone as if they are sensitive. Most of us do not have any idea about the battle that the person sitting across from us is having. And if you act like that person deserves your ultimate respect and isn't going to think your jokes are funny necessarily, you're in a good start. The next part is to report. Trust your HR policy. Go to your HR manager. And if you are an HR manager, be like Tracy. Take it very seriously, because that is a very powerful tool. A laser beam focused disciplinary action against a harasser can make a difference. And the other way is to celebrate the champions, the mentors who are safe, who do promote people, who do treat everyone with dignity, and really celebrate those, because they can be great influencers on the rest of us. So thank you for that opportunity.
Stephanie Polkup, Dave Lane, Tracy Lund, Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels, I want to say thank you to all of you for being here with us today. Really enriching conversation. Thanks so much.